Good morning. It's time for the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Will you still need me? Will you still feed me?
Well, welcome and good morning. I'm Harry Miller.
Oh, you know what?
And I'm with the Jane Marie Schaefer this morning.
Yeah, if I would put her on the air,
the minor technical glitch will be.
Well, that's my own fault. She should be right there.
Good morning, Jane Marie.
Good morning. How are you?
I am good. I am good. How are you? Are you getting ready for the snow?
I am. I just said I'm going to get all my shopping done early before the snow and sleet comes later on.
Well, yeah, I'm going to. I think mine is done. Anyway. But, you know, there's always last-minute stuff that you got to do. Anyway, Jane Marie and I are two of the attorneys with the Herzog Law Firm, and we have four conveniently located offices, starting from north to south in Saratoga Springs, Clifton Park, Albany, and Kingston, New York. And we're here, some combination of the estate planning, estate administration, Medicaid team, each Saturday morning here at the studio to talk to you, get you some information, mostly to answer your phone calls, which we'd love to have, about all sorts of areas involving estate planning, estate administration, asset protection planning, home care, preparation for, you know, sheltering assets for nursing home, beneficiary designations, all kinds of good stuff like that. So Jane Marie and I are going to be here until 9 o'clock this morning, and we would love to talk to you. And you can be our first caller by picking up the phone and dialing us right here in the studio at 518-476-5900. That's 518-476-5900. All right. So, yeah, you know, Jane Marie, this... Next Saturday, it's hard to believe, next Saturday is Christmas. The Saturday after that is New Year's Day. And this is actually our last show of the year. All right? We're wrapping it up for 2021.
Because of the way the holidays fall, that's right. We won't be back until January 8th, I believe.
Yeah. Anyway. So we want to wish all of you, all of our listening audience out there, a wonderfully joyous Christmas holiday and a very, very happy new year. And we will toast you all at midnight on December 31st. You know, I mean, talk about the end of the year. I just, it's the holiday time. It's gift-giving time. And, of course, many people will be getting out their checkbooks this week and writing out checks to their children and grandchildren and other people, perhaps. So, finally, one of the outfalls, I guess, from the inflation levels that we're seeing right now is this year in 2021, the annual gift tax exclusion amount is $15,000. Right, so you can give everybody. In your family, or it doesn't have to be in your family. You can give Jane Marie and me and Ben each a check for $15,000.
Yeah.
Guess what? You don't have to report it to the IRS, and you don't have to pay any gift tax on it. Well, next year, on January 1st, it goes finally after 4 years. It's been stuck at $15,000, going up to $16,000 on January 1st.
That's a big jump.
So on January 1st or 2nd, you get another check for 2022 for $16,000. So just keep that in mind, because it does increase the amount of money you can get away and shelter each year. Now, the other thing's gone up. This may not affect everybody in their audience, but it might affect a few people. The current federal estate tax level is, I believe, $11.7 million, right? Per person.
Right.
Next year, it's going up to $12.02 million. It's going to be north of 12, which means that, again, that a married couple can get the first $24 million of your estate, your taxable estate, is going to pass to your beneficiaries free of federal estate tax. So,
Well, that's a relief to you, isn't it?
What's that?
That's a relief to you, Ben. Now you don't have to worry about Paychecks.
Yeah, thank goodness for that, right?
Finally, Ben has crossed the threshold from $11 million to $12.
Yes, thank
so
you.
So he no longer has to worry about incurring federal estate tax.
Oh, shoot. Boy, I was really worried about that, too.
That's right.
It's true. And I think I couldn't find the New York State estate tax amount, which is currently mm-hmm. $5.93 million.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm pretty sure it's going to go over six. So... At the state level, you know, $6 million is. So we don't have, you know, in the estate administration, Jane Marie mm-hmm. really heads up the estate administration practice in the law firm. And, you know, we do quite a number of probate proceedings in mm-hmm. court. And we always try to avoid those things, right? Because if you have a trust, in all likelihood, you are going to be able to avoid a probate proceeding. Probate proceeding. So, do you want to go through just some of the general outlines of things? Part of the problem with probate is it takes a lot longer than just terminating mm-hmm. a trust and distributing out the assets, right? So, you know, what's the average? Go ahead.
Yeah, it does. And even though, as you said, the majority of our clients have trusts, it does seem like there's many times that we end up in probate because there could be a bank account or a stock that they forgot about that's in their own name, or they, you know, or that they intentionally decided not to put in the trust for whatever reason. So if you have to go to probate, it's this whole process. It's at a minimum, I would say, of about 7 months, but it usually goes up to a year because you need to file a probate petition with the court to get your executor appointed. And then after that, you have to hold open the estate for 7 months to let any creditors file their claims. So you can't really close out the estate for 7 months. Yeah. And then at the end of that, you do have to file all this paperwork with the court to show, you know, what money was in the estate. That's the inventory. You have to get all your beneficiaries to sign a receipt and release agreement agreeing to the amount of money that's going to them. And so there's many spots along the way where there can be delays or trouble. We have cases where beneficiaries want an accounting of how every penny was spent, right? So
they're entitled to that. Yeah, there are nitpicking beneficiaries out there.
Yes, there are.
And all and that stuff ask for has to be.
It takes some time.
The kicker is, I think one of the big kickers when Jane Marie says 7 months, you know, why seven, you know, when you file a probate proceeding and you have the executor appointed, anyone who has a claim against the decedent's estate has like 7 months to file. And it's not 7 months from the date of death. It's 7 months from the date that letters are issued, right?
Yes, 7 months from the date the letters are issued, which could be two, 3 months after the date of death.
Right. So now you're about out probably close to a year from the time the person actually died.
Mm-hmm.
You know, guess what? In most trusts, because you don't have to have probate, and not because you don't have to have probate, but most of these trusts we do are insulated from creditors' claims, right? I mean, a creditor might have a claim against the probate estate, but it doesn't mean they have a claim against your trust, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So we have an added advantage there by not only avoiding probate, but in most instances, insulating the assets that are in the trust. People say, oh, well, my Aunt Helen, she didn't have any bills. She didn't owe any money. Okay, mm-hmm. Well, what about that automobile accident she had 6 months ago before she, you know, before she died? And, you know, that's still pending with the insurance cut. What if we have a personal injury claim against her estate and she didn't have much insurance? She only had the state minimum insurance. Well, guess what? That would be a claim against her estate, right?
Yes, that's right. But they can only go after the money that's in the estate. So if it's only, you know, it's pretty common. You may have one bank account that's in the estate that could be a relatively small amount, like $10,000, $15,000, but you have more money and a house and a trust. Everything that's in the trust is protected from that claim.
Yeah, that's a good idea. So, you know, since we are up against the end of the year, I mean, these are really important things to consider as you're going into the new year. If you haven't if you haven't looked and revisited your estate plan in a number of years, for heaven's sakes, come in and have a review of that done. The other thing I think at the end, if we're doing end-of-the-year cleanup, is really important to do, and people always forget to do on a regular basis, is please review all of the people who you have on your various assets as beneficiaries.
Mm-hmm.
Because the people that you put there 2, 5, 8, 10 years ago may not be the same people who you now want to receive those assets when you pass away. One or two of them may have already died, and things change. People die. They get married. They get divorced. They have children. You have a falling out with them, and you don't want them to get the money anymore. You want them to get less than you were going to give them 2 years ago. So, and the fact of the matter is, I think most people's assets probably pass to a beneficiary in one form or another. In my experience, I think you see it too, probably.
Yeah, I would say most people, I have a beneficiary on one of their accounts. And it's not just your retirement plan or your life insurance. You can put a beneficiary on your bank account. You can put a beneficiary on your, you know, mutual fund account. So it's pretty easy to make sure that you have beneficiaries on everything so that you can avoid probate. And we tell people to do that, right? Even though we handle probate, we would like for you to avoid probate. It's going to be easier for your family.
No, it is. It's a lot easier. It's a lot simpler. It's a lot less expensive because you don't have to have as much lawyer involvement in settling and distributing these assets. So it's kind of a win-win all around.
Right.
So anyway, it's about 8:15, and we would love to hear from some of you out there this morning. If you have a question about anything we're talking about or even something we're not talking about, we'd love to hear from you this morning at 518-476-5900. That's 518-476-5900. So, you know, talking about settling estate and probate, I read an article this week in the New York Times, James Brown, you know, estate finally has it's almost settled. Now, talk about 7 months or a year. James Brown died 15 years ago. My God.
15 years that's been going on.
He's been dead for 15 years. His estate is still in probate. It is still being fought over by a variety of people, including a former executor and the current executor. But the estate has reached an agreement with something called Primary Wave Music. They're going to buy James Brown's book of music, okay?
Mm-hmm.
For guess how much?
$90 million
bucks. $90 million bucks, okay? Woo.
Wow, I was just going to say, Bruce Springsteen just sold his book of music for $200 million,
half a billion. So. I think it was $500 million, yeah.
$500 million.
To Sony. His books and one of the problems with the estate was the original executor valued the assets in the estate at something like $80 or $84 million. She was removed in 2009, and the current guy who was the executor valued it at $6 million. Now that's a huge discrepancy valuation. So, and I'm sure the IRS is involved in this as well from a standpoint of estate tax, although there may not be any estate taxes, because the entire estate is being left to award scholarships to poor children in Georgia and South Carolina. There is some set aside for his grandchildren. I don't think that would qualify as a charitable deduction, but the other might. But the thing that was really taking... Go ahead. The thing that was really taking a long time to solve was... James Brown was married to this woman named Tommy Rae Haveney. All right? He married her in 2001, and I think they were married when he died. The problem is, she was still married to somebody else.
Oops.
Whoops.
Oops.
Forgot about that. Okay, so the question was, she really married to James Brown or not? So the court finally, she and five of his other kids, he had five kids, I think, they spent years litigating with the estate, trying to get a share of the estate. And I think ultimately, the highest court in South Carolina decided that she was not, in fact, married to him because she was still legally married to someone else. And you cannot, at least in South Carolina, be legally married to more than one person. Okay, anyway.
Right. So she wasn't entitled to anything.
There's just a bizarre example of the extreme amounts that a probate proceeding. Now, if it was in a trust, I'm not saying the same problems couldn't have occurred. They could have.
Mm-hmm.
It might have been. I can only imagine what the legal fees that everybody's going to put in for in this estate.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the guy who's the current executor says, well, hey, when he died 15 years ago, his book of business was only worth $6 million, and it's because of my efforts and my negotiations that it suddenly became worth $90 million. And I think he's probably looking for a substantial amount of commissions as a result of his...
a bigger fee, right?
Absolutely. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. Well, in the meantime...
yeah.
None of these scholarships for these poor children in Georgia and South Carolina have been set up because mm-hmm. the state has been in limbo. And so they're hoping that maybe in the next year or two, everybody's claim will finally be resolved. And I guess they can go off and off along their merry way.
I wonder how much will be left after lawyers' fees and executor commission.
They'd be pretty hefty in a $90 million mm-hmm. estate. They'd be... yeah, I can't do that. I can't do that much arithmetic in my head, but suffice it to say, it's a lot of money. It definitely is. So,
well, that's why you should do a trust, because, you know, if you have... I mean, you may not be in his situation, but if you're in a second marriage or a third marriage and you have kids from a prior marriage, you don't want them fighting in court over your estate. So if you use a trust, it's much harder to contest the trust, and it's all and it will be handled outside of court generally. So that's why we recommend a trust, so that you can avoid the situation. Not that you would be in there for 15 years. I don't think we have any estates open that long, but we have some that are going on a couple of years.
Yeah, most of them are wrapped up pretty quickly, and more people are using trusts, particularly, as you point out, in situations where people have had multiple marriages. It's the only way, the only really way that you can legally set up inheritance arrangements that don't rely on good faith is by using a trust to distribute assets, make income and principal available to a second spouse. You know, most people if they're in a second marriage, and probably, you know, statistically, something like 40% to 50% of marriages are second marriages. And so there's a natural tendency to want to provide for the spouse, if it's the second spouse or third. There aren't as many third marriages, I think, but... But then ultimately, at the end of the day, most people want their own children, usually going to be from the first marriage, although not necessarily, to receive the benefit of the family assets. And so if you just leave everything to the second spouse, you're relying on his or her good faith to make sure that happens. And it may happen and it may not happen. So putting it in a trust, controlling it through distributions in a trust, is the only way to make it legally enforceable. And that way, it keeps everybody honest. And it's not even sometimes that the second spouse, is even opposed to that kind of a distribution scheme. But as people get older, they frequently can come under the influence of other people,
yeah.
like their own children, who are not going to benefit from this largesse of the first spouse. It brings out sometimes the availability or the potential inheritance of money absolutely brings out the worst characteristics in people. And so we, as lawyers, want to make sure that we're pointing out to you, the client, exactly what the possibilities are here. So I say, oh, geez, I never thought about it. I didn't think she would do that or he would do that. I say, well, maybe he wouldn't do that, but maybe... Oh, you mean that rotten kid of his? You know, I say he probably. Who knows?
Right.
Families come in all shapes and sizes, but they frequently have common characteristics. I've noticed over the years.
True. It's also pretty common in a second marriage that you would want your spouse to be able to live in the house after you're gone, but then have the house go to your children. So we do a lot of trust where we have language in there where the surviving spouse is given the life use of the property if they want it. And, you know, that's the way to make sure they have somewhere to live and they're protected, but that they don't then leave it to their kids, right? That you can make sure it goes back to your children.
Yeah, it's a whole bunch of, I've done it all different ways. Sometimes I have the surviving spouse has the ability to live there as long as they choose to. But if they're going to do that, they got to pay the taxes, they got to pay the insurance,
right.
Routine maintenance and repairs and utilities. So we want to and we want to keep the house up. We don't want it to run down. And if they don't want to do that or they can't do it, then the trust can direct that the trustee can sell the house and distribute the proceeds however the person wants them distributed. And then, you know, it's interesting because and the reason that there are different considerations here is because sometimes, when in the second spouse didn't contribute anything. It's the first, you know, it's the husband or the wife's house, and the other spouse moves in. Didn't contribute anything to the purchase of the house. Now, in those situations, very often, the spouse who put the money in the house is going to want the money to go to their own family, rather than the second spouse's family. Now, I have other situations where I have one recently where second marriage here, and this person, the first wife died, and I think both of them are widowed. So they got together, and what they did was they bought another house together, 50-50, okay? So they each put in half the money. So if one of them dies, they want the other one certainly to be able to live there as long as they choose to. But when the second one dies or the surviving spouse moves out of the house permanently, then they want the house sold, and they're going to split the money between the two families because she has kids and he has kids. And so that's a different consideration there because they actually all have – they've got money invested in the property. And so it's a completely different kind of a situation than the first one that I outlined. And these are the kinds of things that a lot of times people don't think about, say, oh, well, I never really thought about the house. And because here's the problem. If the second marriage, husband and wife – both buy the house together, 9 times out of 10, how's the deed going to be set up, Jay Marie?
It's going to be set up tenants by the entirety,
which for married people is basically it's a joint tenancy with a right of survivorship, okay? So absent doing something else with the title and ownership of the property, the last man standing is going to wind up with the house, all right? So if the husband dies first, the house, if it's in joint names as opposed to in a trust, is going to pass to the wife. She has complete control over the disposition of the house and the proceeds and can certainly freely leave it all to her children, none of it to his children, even though he put in half the money or maybe even all the money for the purchase of the house initially. So that strikes most people as somewhat unfair. But at the same time, most people don't think about this stuff. That's why... You got to come in and re-review your estate plan about it at least every 5 years to make sure these things, if they're happening to you, or so we're gonna pick your brain and review all that stuff and make sure that we ultimately you're the person who's going to make the decision. Our job is to point out the different variables, the different options, so that you can make the most informed choice that works for you and your family.
Right. So certainly if you get remarried or if you buy a house, those are the kind of triggering events that should make you come in and see us and just check over everything.
You bet.
No, there's no changes. We'll tell you there's no changes, but likely in a situation that's big like that, you know, we're going to want to change your documents.
Yep. There are the other things you ought to obviously make sure that are up to date and recent is your health care proxies, your powers of attorney. Excuse me, I had a situation this week. A family I had not talked to in 10 years, okay? They had just basic wills. And you know, a fairly, you know, not a small estate. It's probably over $1 million. And so they hadn't been in to see me in 10 years. And guess what happened? One of their daughters who lives out of town came in to see mom and dad for the holidays. And they're looking at this stuff, say, we ought to. So the couple is older, and because of the increasing incidence now of this Omicron, you know, the Omicron variant of the virus. So we did a Zoom. We're getting back to starting to do more Zoom conferences in our office because some of the older people are concerned, even though they're vaccinated and boosted, about running around all things. And that's a natural, that's an understandable thing. So we get on a Zoom call with the husband and the wife and the daughter. And so guess what? The husband has Parkinson's disease, all right? And they have home care in the house right now. They have private paid home health care aides. And so I said, well, look, you know, maybe we should revisit the documents because maybe the husband, because he has some disabilities as a result of the Parkinson's disease, he may not be able to act as his wife's power of attorney or her health care proxy at this point. But he's the one who's on the documents that they signed 10 years ago. So we're going to redo them and put the daughter on for the mother instead of the father. Now, the mother can still be dad's healthcare proxy because she's perfectly fine. And then the other thing we talked about was they're currently paying for home care, and we might be able to get some Medicaid coverage for them.
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely. Some people don't think to let us know about those developments. And, I mean, we could talk more about this after the break, but you've had the case, and I have, where clients have paid for a nursing home privately, even down to, you know, spending down all their funds when instead of giving us a call where they could have saved some money, you know, and that's often because the nursing home tells them that they have to pay.
Understood. I think the guy with the pink headphones on has gotten up. I think we may be...
Well, I think we're close enough now. It is 8:30, so we're going to take our break right here. We'll be right back after this message with the second half of the Herzog Law Firm's Estate Medicaid Planning Hour coming up right after this.
You've been listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. Join us every week to learn more about protecting the assets you've worked hard for, options available for Medicaid planning, and more. With offices located in Corporate Woods in Albany, West Harrison Street in Saratoga Springs, Executive Woods in Clifton Park, and 130 North Front Street in Kingston, our attorneys are here to help you. If you'd like to schedule an appointment to speak with David, Jane Marie, or Harry, please call us during normal business hours Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. To contact us at our Albany office, call 518-465-7581. Our Saratoga Springs office, 518-581-8131. Our Clifton Park office at 518-952-4010. And our Kingston office at 845-338-6405. Let the Herzog Law Firm help navigate a plan that works for you and your family. Now back to the Estate and Medicaid Plan Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
And welcome back to the Herzog Law Firm's Estate Medicaid Planning Hour. I'm Harry Miller.
And I'm Jane Marie Schaefer.
And as you know, Jane Marie and I are two of the attorneys with the Herzog Law Firm. And we are here chatting with you this morning about end of year things that you ought to think about, consider, and start acting on with respect to your own estate plan, your own beneficiary designations, and all sorts of issues like that. And I'm just amused I'm so happy to be back in the studio after like a year and a half. I don't know, Ben. It was been what was it? February or March? When did we shut everything down?
It was March of 2020. It's been a year and 9 months.
So it's a year and nine months, and then I walk in. This guy is sitting here with his pig. I'm sorry.
That's right.
But I got to ask you. Did you? You said somebody threw the headphones. We were going to throw the headphones away.
Yeah, they were
wonderful. Was it Barbie?
I don't know. I don't know, but the nice part about it is
they're pink, yeah, just like the Barbie mobile.
Yeah, that's right. Then they only had one side that worked, and folks that know me or see me in action before, I only wear one headphone so I can hear out of the other ear. So it was perfect for me. It was like gold. I just found it and said, oh, this is awesome. You know, most people would have said, oh, these headphones are ruined, but I only wear them on one ear, so I was fine.
Quite attractive.
Thank you very much, Harry. I have been known to be in touch with my feminine side, and I'm good to go today.
Okay, so we would love to talk to you this raucous last half hour of the Lentside, last show of the year for 2021. Next Saturday is Christmas, and so we will not be here. You will rather be entertained with, I'm sure, lots of Christmas music. And the Saturday after that is New Year's Day, so... You know. Mm-hmm. I don't know, what kind of music you play on New Year's Day? Do you play Auld Lang Syne? Or
yeah, we'll probably have that in there. I was hoping that we would actually. I was hoping that we wouldn't be working, so that would be nice. Oh. But I'll be here, so you know, on New Year's Day. But that's okay. That's all right, because you know, folks are enjoying. You know, a lot of folks with their holidays and stuff. They may not get together this coming weekend for Christmas, but they will get together for New Year's. So if you have folks from a long ways away that you don't see all that often, maybe they make it up for the second weekend, and that'll be nice. Yeah. You know, and I know you guys talk about it on the show all the time, how, you know, you kind of look at mom and dad, grandma and grandpa, and see if there's any changes and things like that. And it could, you know, those kind of things could be a game changer, especially around the end of the year.
Yeah, if it's a great point you bring up, Ben, because you know this is a great opportunity in the next 2 weeks to sort of do an informal check of your parents or older relatives who you might be seeing either at their house or them coming to your house. I mean, just you know the telltale signs of how do they look? Are they well groomed? You know, is their clothing clean? When you look in the refrigerator, you know, is there food in the refrigerator? Is there piled up mail on the dining room table that hasn't been opened in a couple of weeks or even longer? We got to do a checkup, and it's not like you're spying on people, but everybody. I've been through this with my own family. I've been through this with my wife's family. The older they get, the more independent they want to be, and that's very understandable. But the response always is, oh, I'm fine. I don't need any help, right? Well, in a lot of cases, that's a lot of baloney, right?
Right. One thing you got to look at is the car. That's a big issue, is one, someone should stop driving. I had a client this week that we've been trying to get the car away from the husband, you know, grandfather, and we couldn't, and the family couldn't, and he drove into a ditch. And the police were called, and they looked up his driving record, and he had several of these. So they basically told him that his driver's license is suspended and he can't drive anymore. Which is great, at least because that's coming from him and the police, I should say, and not from the family. So they're going to get the car away from him.
Well, and that's great. If the license is suspended, the motor vehicle department can do that. You can even have a doctor do that. But if the person has cognitive issues, if the car is still sitting in the driveway or the garage, they may not remember that their license is suspended tomorrow morning and just get out and drive the car. So we got to watch out for, we kind of got to, as you know, there's a lot of role reversal that happens as our parents age, and we in many instances become the parent, and we're going to take care of our parents because they need the help. But the resistance is always there. I mean, it's rare. Occasionally, I have a parent, usually a mother, who understands that she needs help and really appreciates the help. But a lot of them really resent it quite a bit. And particularly, I hate to say it, guys, but men are the worst ones in terms of the car. I mean, geez, it's just women are fine. And I don't mean to be, you know, misogynistic about it, but or sexist, but I mean, women generally, I don't know, they just seem to have a lot more common sense sometimes than men. But they seem to know when it's appropriate not to be driving anymore. I don't know. They have, maybe that's just the maternal, I don't know what it is.
Most women probably do, but I am personally never giving up my car keys, so I'm just telling you that right now.
My mother-in-law never forgave my wife when she took away the car at 93, I believe it was. At 93, we finally set the last two. Her car was falling apart. She had like a 15 or 16-year-old. I don't even know what it was anymore. So we got rid of the car and we leased her a car. And we just got a 2-year lease because I think she was 91, 93 or 94. The lease was up. We said, boom, that's it. No more car. She never got over it. She just kept saying, there's no reason I couldn't be driving this car. There's no reason I can't drive this car. And I said, Marge, excuse me. You might be able to sit in the seat and operate the car, but right now you can't even put the seatbelt on without assistance. And how are you going to get your walker in the back seat of the trunk and then get into the car? I guess so. Realistically, you're past
that point. You have to get right.
Yeah, you just got to give it up. But boy, it's never easy. So listen, 518-476-5900. If you're out there, maybe there's nobody out there this morning. Hey. We love to hear from you. If nothing else, say Merry Christmas, Happy New Year. And right here in the studio, again, the number is 518-476-5900. You aren't, Jay Marie, because you aren't old enough. But those of us who receive Social Security are getting a 5.9% increase this year.
Biggest one in a long time, right?
Yeah, thanks to inflation, which is happening, and that's nice. But do you know how much your Medicare premiums are going up? They're going up 14.5%. All right, so it's going to chew up some of that 5.9% increase in your Social Security check, because those of you who are paying $148.50. Which is the standard if your income's less than about $150,000 a year. Single is 91, married it's like 150. Your Medicare premium is going up to $170 a month. So it's going to go up $22 a month. So that's going to eat up at least not all of it, but some chunk of your Social Security increases. And you know the reason it's such a big bump is interesting because, first of all, there are projected rising prices in medical costs and things like that. And also, the Part B premium increases were capped for the last several years. So they're making up for the fact that they were capped at $148 and now going forward they're not. But the biggest reason for the increase, we'll have to wait a minute because we got a caller. I'm going to go to Barb in Gilderland, who is on the phone waiting to talk to us. Good morning, Barb.
Good morning, everyone. I have a question about trusts versus beneficiaries on bank accounts. I have right now all my bank accounts set up with beneficiaries so that, I avoid probate. But I have limited assets, and I was wondering if I'd be better off putting the bank accounts in a trust so that down the road I could avoid, anything with Medicaid or Medicare, and also maybe get benefits from community Medicare if I need home care.
You want to take that one, Jane Marie?
Yeah, sure. No, that's a great question. So having beneficiaries on your account, as you said, that avoids probate, which is good, but it doesn't mean that it protects those assets or takes them out of your name if you need Medicaid, right? So in order to do that, you would have to do a trust and put those accounts into the trust. And now once those accounts are out of your name, you could be eligible for community Medicaid. And right now, you could be eligible right away for community Medicaid because there is no look-back period. But sometime next year, we don't know exactly what month, there's going to be a 2.5-year look-back for community Medicaid. So that means you would have to have the trust set up in advance of the time that you need Medicaid. I mean, it doesn't sound like you would need help right now. Sounds like you're looking for help in the future. Is that right?
Yeah. Also, I'm currently 70 years old, so I'm reaching that age where I have to think about these kind of issues. And is there a minimum amount that you need to have to put or establish a trust?
Do you own a house, for instance?
No, I don't own a home. I just have bank savings accounts.
It depends. I think, the best thing probably if you just came in and we sat down, did an appointment, and, we don't charge for any initial consultations, we could really look at it and see if there was some way to accommodate the trust. I don't know, and I don't want to talk about amounts of money over the radio, but that would be the best way probably to handle it. The other thing you have to understand about beneficiary designations is they are limited in a lot of ways. And the other thing is some financial institutions have different rules about beneficiaries than others. So let's say you had a bank account that was in beneficiary form to two of your children. I don't know, this is just an example. Some beneficiary designation forms for that bank may say, well, if one of those two beneficiaries dies before you do, it all goes to the other beneficiary. And you might say, well, wait a minute. If that happened, I would want my deceased child's share to go to her kids. She has two kids. Other financial institutions will let you name the grandchildren as contingent if the child passed away, and others don't. And the problem with the beneficiary form, if you ever read those things, I'm assuming your eyes are good enough to read the fine print, because it really is fine print, you have to understand the differences between those things. Some of the forms have a box that you check that says per stirpes, all right? I mean, do you know what per stirpes means, Barbara?
It means following the bloodline, right?
All right. Hey, you're good. You're good. You're good. We have really smart listeners here on this show. I want to tell you, they are well read, well educated, and they chat, really interesting questions. I'm impressed. All right. She may have gone to law school. I don't know. She just knows. Anyway, so you're right. It means through the bloodlines, and that's what it means. And so, these are the things that we don't know. And the other thing, as Jane Marie was pointing out, if something happens to you, if you need home care, if you have to go to a nursing home or something like that, the fact that it's in beneficiary form doesn't protect it from having to be spent on those things. Where if it's in a trust, it can become protected over within 5 years. And if it's home care, as Jane Marie said, there's no look-back penalty currently for home care, I think at least through July 1st. That's my understanding. But beyond that, we have no way of knowing whether that's going to be extended further or not. So we have to assume it's not going to be. And then anybody who transferred assets since like October of what, 2020 or 2019, is going to be
penalized.
October 2020. But the look back, the transfer look back goes back to October of 2020. So we're more than a year past the look back. So everyone who's transferred any assets since last October is now going to suddenly have as much as a 2.5-year penalty for home care applications, which can currently be avoided. Now, you can't just, you can't pre-apply for home care. You have to actually need home care on a current basis. It's not like you can apply and say, well, I'm going to need home care in 2 or 3 years. you have to actually need the care before you can submit an application. So the only people who could do that right now are people who lack two of the five activities of daily living and would require some home care at home. But it's a wonderful program that not everybody knows about.
Well, I've been hesitant to, or I've been considering the trust, but hesitant because I need liquidity. Does the trust provide liquidity of assets in case I need to access some of the money?
Well, it could. It does. It's not liquid like your bank accounts are now. You could just walk into the bank and withdraw whatever, $1,000, $10,000, whatever. You can close out the whole account. If it's in a trust, the kind of trust that protects your assets from nursing home expenses, you can't be the trustee. Somebody else has to be the trustee. One of your children. If you have children, if you don't, someone else, a relative, a cousin, a niece, a sister, a brother, would have to be the trustee. Now, you have indirect control over that person because you can always remove them and appoint someone else. And even though the assets are in the trust, only the trustee can withdraw the money. You can't walk into the bank and withdraw $10,000 from your trust. So you have to take the trustee and go and do those things. But you can access the money through what's called a partial revocation of the trust. There's a little bit of paperwork and some steps you have to go through, but you do have liquidity, but you don't have as much liquidity as you do now, but you also have no protection. So that's the trade-off, is you've got to give up a little bit of liquidity in order to get the protection down the road for the assets. And that's something we can talk about if you come in for a free appointment. We can talk about that, and you could come to, depending, I forget where you live, but, you know, any one of our four conveniently located offices.
Yeah, I'm in Gilderland, so I'll place a call to your office next week and make an appointment to come in to discuss it. And I just want to wish everyone, including Ben, a very happy holiday season.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Barbara. Have a great holiday. Have a great new year.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. Ken up in Rensselaerville is on the phone. Hey, Ken.
Morning.
Morning. How are you?
Good. How you doing?
I am great.
I got a question. About 10 years ago, I set up all my trusts and stuff with you guys. You took care of all of that, and nothing's really changed much, so I don't know whether I should probably come in and update it or... I mean, nothing's really changed much since then.
You know what I'd suggest? You know what I'd suggest, Ken, instead of making an appointment, why don't you call my secretary or whatever lawyer helped, you know, whoever, and why don't we set up a phone appointment rather than running all the way down here from Rensselaerville for nothing? But what I can do that, we can pull the file, and we can go through everything on the phone, probably in about 20 minutes or so, and just look at everything. Check addresses, make sure everybody's still the person you want. And again, we'd be happy to do that. We don't charge a fee for those kinds of updates. I mean, it's like, you know, you get a free checkup, I guess. You get a free checkup.
I have a second question.
Go ahead.
I know that if I went into a nursing home, they're going to look back 5 years to make sure I didn't, like, give away all my money and that kind of thing.
That's right.
My question is, given the time of the year we're in, and, you know, I'm sitting down and writing the checks to all my grandchildren and whatnot, is there any guidance as to how much of a gift I can give to people in the ordinary course of life? And also, I've got grandkids that are going to be going to college soon. Is there any rules as to what extent I can maybe help them out with college without having Medicaid saying that's an illegal gift of an asset or something?
Yeah, what you need to do, if you're concerned about that, is there's no limit or amount, minimum or maximum, but what the county looks for, if you do apply, is do you have some consistent pattern of gift giving throughout the course of the last 5 years? If you write a check for $1,000 to each of your kids and $500 to each of your grandchildren at Christmas time or whatever, Hanukkah, and you do that regularly, those gifts are not supposed to count against you or penalize you for Medicaid. Now, you can't write a check for $1,000 every Christmas and then write a check for $25,000 a year, you have to go into the nursing home. That is not a consistent pattern of gift giving, all right? And the same is true. If every time, if when one of your grandchildren goes to college, you know, you give them $10,000 toward their tuition, or you pay the whole tuition for them, if you do that on a consistent basis over a period of years, I think we could successfully argue that those are not gifts that should be penalized. Do you agree with that, Jamie?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
People, you know, like I have a client who every time one of their granddaughters gets married, I think they give them like $5,000 toward, you know, as a wedding gift. And they've done that for all four of their grandchildren. So there's nothing unusual about that. Now, if three of your grandchildren are already got married and you didn't give them anything, and the year before you have to go to the nursing home, you give the last one, that would be highly questionable, and you might lose on that, on the argument on that one. So
could you argue a change of circumstance? Like, let's say, for some reason, I have a lot more money now than I did before, and that's the reason I didn't give away so much to begin.
Well, that's an argument we could make. you know, we would make it. I don't know. These decisions are made on a county by county basis. I mean, for instance, I had a situation once where a woman, her daughter had some health, she had some adverse health conditions, and she had to stop working, and she was about to lose her house in foreclosure. So the mother, who was perfectly healthy, living independently, driving her car, basically paid off her daughter's mortgage on her house. All right. 2 years later, the mother had a stroke and had to go to a nursing home. The county said, oh, no, you gave away the money. Said, no, she didn't. She was perfectly healthy at the time she made this gift. She had no anticipation of going into a nursing home at that point. This was not a gift that should be penalized. And the case was successful. All right. Mm-hmm. They didn't penalize. You know, the administrative law judge said, no, you shouldn't be penalized because she was perfectly healthy when she made the gift. I don't, you know, these things are made on a county by county basis. And sometimes if we get the county social worker reviewing the file may deny the gift, we may have to go to an administrative hearing, you know, it's called a fair hearing before an administrative law judge to get it overturned. But, you know, We do those things, and we've had some rate of success in those things. Yes.
Oh, thank you very much. I'll give you a call about that trust, and we'll get that straightened out.
Yeah, good. I mean, I'm around. Okay. You know, I'm around through the holidays. I'm not. You know, I'm here.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Have a nice holiday, you all.
You too. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you,
Ken. So something else that comes up this time of year is people are starting to go to warmer climates for the winter. And
thinking about that myself,
and you're one of them, right? So maybe you can talk to this because we get a lot of questions about, you know, if I'm spending the winter in Florida, you know, or North Carolina, maybe do I need to have documents down there or my New York documents? Okay. What do you advise clients about that, Harry?
Well, I advise them to have one in both. For instance, I live in New York most of the time, but my wife and I have a little place down in North Carolina where we're going to probably toward the end of January for a month or two. And guess what? We have New York healthcare proxies, living wills, and powers of attorney. We also have North Carolina healthcare proxies, living wills, and powers of attorney. In case we get sick down there, it's just easier, and it's very inexpensive to get these documents prepared and done. So if we get sick down in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and I got to go to the hospital, I got a North Carolina healthcare proxy that will not result in confusion or delay. If we got to go to a bank and leave a power of attorney there at the bank because I can't write my name anymore, my wife has to take care of stuff. It's convenient form. Our New York documents are legal in North Carolina. The North Carolina documents are legal in New York. But if I took my North Carolina power of attorney to a bank here in Albany, I can guarantee you it's unfamiliar. The branch manager is going to say, well, we need a day or two to review this. and we may have to have our lawyer just make sure it's okay and this and that, because they don't want to use a power of attorney, and it's not, the North Carolina form is not a statutory New York power of attorney form. All right, so it can result in some delay and some confusion. So the simplest thing is to have one for each place where you spend time in the winter.
Absolutely, that's what we tell our clients. And but your will, you leave as a New York will. Is that right? Or your trust?
We have a trust. We have a New York trust that basically owns our house in New York and our house in North Carolina. Okay, and the fact that we go to North Carolina once in a while, we don't have to change the trust in North Carolina. It's perfectly fine. All right, we're still New York residents. We still file New York State income tax returns, and all that stuff. So, you don't, if you own property in more, and a lot of people do. They have a place here. They got a place in Florida. They got a place in, you know, wherever. You don't have to have each property in a separate trust. You can put everything in the same trust. And, you know, it's a great way to consolidate your assets into a single place. That is the trust. And guess what? If you people who own property in more than one state, if you don't have it in a trust, you're going to wind up doing two probate proceedings instead of just one, which we were starting to talk about, you know, at the top of the hour, the 7 months, the, you know, James Brown's 15-year estate that's been going on and on. You have to probate the will in New York and North Carolina in order to sell the properties or transfer them to whoever your beneficiary is, you know, at the end of the day. So, you know, with that in mind, I just want to wish everybody a wonderful, joyous Christmas and a very, very happy New Year. I want to wish you and your family. You got your kids home yet? Or are they coming home this week?
They are done with finals. They are home, yes.
All right. Well, I guess we're done for the rest of the year anyway. So everybody have a great, great holiday, and we will talk to you in early January.
Thank you for listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. For more information on their services, please visit herzoglaw.com. If you'd like to speak with one of their attorneys, please contact the Albany office at 518-465-7581, the Saratoga office at 518-581-8131, or their Kingston office at 845-338-6405.